Social service providers in Dane County report that domestic violence is an ongoing problem in Latino immigrant families. The risk of domestic violence in immigrant families is increased by the stress of immigration, which includes the isolation of being non-English speakers and the loss of extended family networks. The piling up of stresses happens when Latino immigrant families are adjusting to major cultural changes at the same time as they're raising young children and coping with economic demands. It is no surprise that the pot often boils over. That's from a funded grant proposal for a program working to prevent violence in Latino immigrant families. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
What special challenges do Latino families face when it comes to child rearing, couples' relationships, and family structure? How hard is it to straddle two different cultures, receiving conflicting messages about parenting and marriage from the Latino community and the American mainstream? Joining us to discuss her work with biculturalism in the Latino family is Lynette Utall, a professor in the UW Department of Human Development and Family Studies and director of the Asian American Studies Program.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Good morning, Norm and Emily.
I was having a conversation one time with a Peruvian woman who had long since settled in this country. And between us, we sort of came to this conclusion, well, what does this Latino name mean anyway? But if you're talking about a Peruvian or a Cuban in Miami or a migrant worker in California or a fifth-generation Mexican-American in Texas, it's a lot of territory to cover. What do they have in common?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the term to use to identify this group is very complicated. Most people actually use the term Hispanic, which is a term that the U.S. Census Bureau coined, and it actually included all Spanish-speaking people, including those who come from Spain. And during the 70s, there was a lot of objection to the term Hispanic, and communities started renaming themselves and embracing the term Latino instead, mainly because what they wanted to do was to make the distinction that Spanish-speaking people from Spain were not the same as those who were coming from Mexico, Cuba, Puerto Rico, other South American and Central American countries. The term has both a political dimension. It refers to a pan-ethnic group that shares, especially in this current context of immigration reform and immigration debates. It refers to a lot of people who are concerned about their well-being and ability to be here in the United States. And so it has that political term. Right here in Madison, Wisconsin, it refers to a group that includes a very diverse set of ethnicities, probably more so than, for example, in Phoenix, Arizona, or other places in the Southwest where you have mostly Mexican-Americans. So most people, when they think of Latinos, they think, oh, Mexican-Americans. But in fact, the term has a more pan-ethnic meaning. And like right here in Madison, frequently like a group of Latinos will get together and go, for example, to the mayor's office to ask for better child care funding. Or when a group of Latinos get together, they're very aware that they are not all from the same place. They are speaking different dialects of Spanish. Some of them, Spanish is actually their second language because their first language is a dialect, an Indian dialect from Mexico. And they're very aware that although they share and often frequently use this term Latino, that there's a lot of diversity amongst them as well.
Would that include Latinos, would that include people whose first language is English?
It could. Oh, good point. Because Latinos also isn't, I focus on immigrants, and Latinos are not just immigrants as well. They are also people who have been here for four generations, and so their first and only language can be English. You know, they have long forgotten how to speak Spanish in the family. Another interesting point, though, is that I think when you're looking at the first and the second and probably into the third generation of Latino immigrants, that even if you're a Latino, meaning Mexican-American or Cuban-American or, you know, second generation here in the United States, Your life is still very much influenced by the history of immigration in your background. And so even if you don't speak Spanish, the fact that you probably have cultural influences as well as the experience of being a member of a group that is considered a racial ethnic minority group will influence how you see yourself. So there's kind of a sense of identity, and as well as some people take that to the level of political being as well, but not all. Mm-hmm. But there's a real sense of identity that it does matter to be Latino. It's not, do you speak Spanish or not? Were mm-hmm. you born in the United States or not? Are you documented or not? These are, you know, sort of the surface level things that people use probably more in like the political realm. But in the realm that I work in, which is really the daily lived experience realm, the everyday lives of people, they're not asking those kind of questions, but they're talking more about what does it mean that we have our foot in two worlds, that even if we are born here or because we came here just 3 weeks ago, we're living with two cultures, two societies at the same time.
What are the cultural unifying elements, though, that make mm-hmm. Latinos then?
I'm going to sort of dodge that question, because one of the main things that I like to teach my students and also realize is going on when I'm working with the community is that it's not that there is this uniform culture. There's the U.S. culture, and then there's the quote-unquote Latino culture. Okay, because remember, culture is really specific to an ethnic heritage. You know, are you from Mexico? Are you from Oaxaca in Mexico? Are you from a particular indigenous group in Mexico? You know, it gets that specific. But what is common across all of this is it the process or the experience of living between two sets of cultures or two sets of values. And so the common one here is and we really shouldn't do this to Americans either, but there is perceived to be a common American culture. And it is typically talked about as being a very individualistic culture, a very materialistic culture, a culture of individuals rather than a culture of families and communities. Okay. And then that gets juxtaposed with the immigrant experience, which is where I come from. Our relationships with each other are really important. Family is not just your mother, father, brothers, and sisters, but it's also your aunts, uncles, cousins, and that third and fourth cousin who you're not even sure how they're related to you, mm-hmm. but they're regularly around you, and communities, because living in a community, for example, in Guadalajara, it means there's actually a group of people around you who have known you for a long time. I think one of the things that I've learned that really is surprising to me is that many people, for example, in Mexico, are born in a neighborhood and they live in the same house that their parents grew up in. And it's not because there's literally just one house there, but as families expand, the land will get divided, or the house, if you can imagine, courtyard will get divided, and people will be given parts of the house so that they can raise their own families there. So it's very different than the United States, where we move. You know, you grow up in one city, you go to college in another, you move to another for a job, you know, or you just move. You know, the ties to stay in one place in the U.S. are very fragile. But for immigrants that I'm familiar with, they come from cultures where you have these sort of connections. And so what that means is, in terms of values, and speaking specifically, you know, about how you raise your children, the value of how you relate to another person is very, very important. And so this is like probably the question you had really kind of gets at the heart of what are the differences, but then how do you live with that difference that in one place it's very focused on the individual, and in another place you're judged about whether you're a good person based on how you relate to other people.
And what in your own personal and professional background do you think made you interested in studying Latino families and sort of the immigrant experience?
Oh, well, that's a great question, because if you look at me, some people would see a Latina, but I'm actually not. My mother is Japanese and my father is Russian Jewish. But I think this speaks a little bit to how important it is how we look to how people objectively look at us and then decide who we are. So I did my graduate work in California. And in California, it's a predominantly, you know, state with a large Latino population and predominantly Mexican-American. As a qualitative in-depth researcher, I'm very sensitive that there are real limits to how much you can know another person's experience. So, for example, when I was doing research on the relationship between employed mothers and their childcare arrangements, I was interviewing whites, blacks, and Mexican-Americans. I actually did dabble in a few interviews with Mexican immigrants with a translator and immediately decided that given the type of knowledge that I was seeking out, what is your life really like, that I couldn't do that through a translator. So I didn't do anything with Mexican immigrants when I was actually in California. The route into the projects that I do here in Wisconsin have to do with when I came here, I did have a research group with students on biculturalism, because one of the things that I do share with immigrants or children of immigrants is this having grown up in a bicultural home, you know, bicultural, bi-religious, bi-national, because my mother actually, although she was born in the U.S., she was raised in Japan and came back to the U.S. as an adult. So I sort of recognize at some point that I'm really the daughter of an immigrant, you know, and experience a lot of the things that I'm observing in the community work that I'm doing. So I do like to be very clear about that, that I'm not Spanish-speaking fluently, and I'm also not from a Latino background. Yeah.
When you talk about the difficulties of living in two different cultures for Latinos in this country, mm-hmm. is there a distinction between documented versus undocumented? It seems to me there'd be even more stresses for those who have to worry about the INS, you know, knocking on the door in the middle of the night.
Yeah. Homeland Security, which has replaced INS, is truly a monster for undocumented people in the United States. But it also has this effect on all, it's interesting, Latino people. I mean, there are also many undocumented Canadians, but we don't talk
don't about, hear about them
we don't talk
up,
about
do
the
you?
Problem of Canadians coming across the border illegally. But again, in the same way that I, by association, was perceived to be Latino, documented people who are Latino are perceived to be undocumented. So if ICE is going to do a raid on a business and they're half the workers or most of the workers are documented, but they're Latino, they're going to pick them all up. They're not just going to start looking at people's papers right there on the spot. They're
going to sort it out later.
Yeah. And it's very scary because they literally do take people into detention. And because even if you're documented, it doesn't mean that you necessarily speak English well. Oftentimes, the communication problems result in the wrong people being held, and it's just a nightmare.
I know the Go Big Read selection this year,
yes,
which I just finished, was the Enrique's Journey by Sonia Nazario, who will be coming to Madison and speaking with us on this program. But it was heartrending, the tales of, for example, a young Honduras boy who had just dreadful conditions trying to get to America to reach his mother, who had left behind mm-hmm. children to go and try to earn a living, but would spend maybe 10 years away from these young children, mm-hmm. not out of sort of neglect, but out of trying to
believing
help them survive.
This was a rational way to, you know, it makes sense given the context of their lives. Actually, last May, I was in Honduras working on a service learning project. And one of the great opportunities of that trip was that we were working side by side with a group of 15 to 19-year-olds from a local community college, technical college. And I was talking at great length with this one young man about, you know, who he was. And I'm always curious. And it's interesting how they'll say very quickly, oh, I have a mother and she lives in Kentucky. And I said, mm-hmm. oh, that's really interesting. And I said, well, you know, and he said, and I said, well, who are you living with now? And he said, well, with my aunt. And I said, oh, okay. So why don't you go live in Kentucky with your mom? And he said, oh, well, I went up there for a week and I stayed there, but I really didn't like the United States. So he chose to come back to live with his aunt in Honduras rather than staying with his mother. And this had been for many years now. I mean, he was 18 and he had been doing this since he was 11 years old. So he's not familyless in Honduras. You know, he has his aunts who's taking care of him. That fits more with that idea of the extended family and everything. He communicates with his mother. I mean, one of the very interesting things right now is that technology, cell phones, computers really do allow parents and children to have relationships with each other. It's just through technology. And so they're not going to be getting the daily living kind of thing that we think of as family life, but they are still having real connections. I mean, it's very different than, for example, when my grandmother immigrated to the United States. You know, she came on a boat, she got off in San Francisco, and she lived in the United States having no communication with her parents, except for when they were able to get back on the boat and have a visit. Same thing with my own mother. When she came to the United States when she was 23, I remember her writing these letters on these little blue aerogram airmail things that they used for international mail. And maybe once every 5 years, she would get on the telephone and hear her mother and father's voice. In fact, she did not return to Japan before her father died, you know, and didn't get to see him again once she left Japan. So, but today the experience is much different because there's a much more transnational kind of communication going on and everything.
There's a,
not that it's good,
kind of an informal relationship between the U.S. government and Latino immigrants, illegal immigrants, and that is, the U.S. government realizes that there is a need for a fair number of workers of one kind or another from south of the border and seems to turn a blind eye to a certain number of them, and yet at the other hand pursues some too. It's a kind of a hard relationship to define in some ways. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, the government and, of course, a lot of employers realize that without them, there'd be all kinds of collapse, especially in parts of the country.
Yeah, this is what makes the immigration debate so complicated. I mean, you have those business people whose businesses would absolutely collapse. I mean, this is very true here in Wisconsin as well, that there's a lot of businesses that without the workers from south of the border, they would not be able to make it. And that's both documented and undocumented because, again, the reality is if you're from Mexico, the wage that you think is good is much lower than what an American here in the United States is willing to work for. So in order for small businesses, especially our farms here in Wisconsin, to survive, they need to have this low-paid workforce. So that's one issue. You know, restaurants, if you really did deport all the undocumented Mexican workers out of Dane County, Dane County's economy would probably collapse. But that's the economic story. And this is one place where I wish the business world would win, because if they had their way, they would probably say, open the border. Let's stop making noise about this because we need those workers. They don't totally want to do that because part of the function that illegality performs is that it creates a labor force that will work for less and will be very compliant because of the fear of being deported. You know?
So you have a lot of people who are living in poverty and living in fear.
Yeah. And that
in
was
the shadows.
That was the point I wanted to make when you asked me about the question between undocumented and undocumented, is that it bleeds out and affects everybody, not just the individual who actually has the papers or not. So, for example, there's this idea of what's called a mixed status family, okay, where, for example, both the parents are undocumented immigrants, but both the children are born in the United States, or one of the parents is undocumented and they met somebody here who is documented, and one child is born in the United States and the other one was born in Mexico. It was even more complicated probably in the past because the borders have really tightened up in the last 8 years.
Well, the wall, among other things.
Yeah. And so you know, in the past, actually, there was a lot of fluidity. So you got a lot of more mixing of undocumented and documented. And there was much less enforcement. People really didn't care that there were that many undocumented workers here. They were literally becoming part of our society in a very kind of functional, useful, kind way for everybody. But it is this whole anti-immigration stuff is so new. And so on top of like there is that one voice that's saying, well, they're taking jobs away from us. OK, so that's one of the arguments that's used to tighten up the borders. But like you pointed out, our economy is so dependent on this a labor force of undocumented workers that that's not really the issue. You do have this group that's very nativist, you know, who's really an American. For example, we have for a really long time had laws that said if you're born in the United States, you're an American citizen,
right. Mm-hmm.
Period. There's no question about that. It's true that other countries, I think France, for example, you cannot become a citizen just because you're born in the country. Your parents both have to be citizens. And so you have a lot of immigrants in France. The children are born in France, but they're actually not French citizens their whole lives. So there is a small movement to try to create that here in the United States, that you just because you're born here, it doesn't mean that you get to be a U.S. citizen automatically. I find that really scary.
I kind of think that takes a constitutional amendment.
Oh, probably. Mm-hmm. And it's very scary because it feeds right into this, you know, anti-undocumented immigrant feelings. And so it's the kind of thing that maybe 5 years ago I would have said, this is so bizarre, it should never happen. And now I'm hearing of actually, you know, some subgroups really working hard on this, which is sad because, again, if we take it back to the human dimension, you know, that realm that I'm in, like, how do people really live their lives? You know, not whether it's legally right or you know, or the politics of it and all that. Just how are families, you know, how are men, women, children, young adults right here in Dane County living their lives in this context? And it's very oppressive and very, it's like you mentioned, Emily, it's created like this sort of shadow of fear over the whole community, whether you're legally documented or not.
And we're going to talk about the stresses that places on parenting and on couples' relationships when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Lynette Utall, and we are talking about biculturalism and the Latino family. Let's talk about parenting, because that's one of the places that biculturalism gets complicated, because not only do you have parents who are straddling two worlds, but then they have these children that go to American schools or have American peers, watch American TV. It gets very complicated. So tell us some of your work having to do with Latino families and the stresses on parents.
Yeah. Well, first, let me put you into the mindset of an immigrant parent. There are a lot of reasons that people immigrate to the United States. Economic is clearly one of the big reasons. But another huge reason is for the educational opportunities. And so many parents will come to the United States because they see this as a way that they can give their children a better life. And so what that means is when they come to the United States, they want their kids to go to school. They want their kids to learn English. They want their kids to assimilate and be great Americans so that they can get great American jobs. Okay. And this is, you know, the American dream. What immigrant parents aren't thinking about when they leave their countries and make this choice for their family is what impact is this going to have on the family's values and practices and their way of life, okay? And what they don't realize is that one of the things that happens, especially as their kids enter the child care and the school arena, is that the parents start feeling like they're losing their children. Their children definitely stop knowing how to speak Spanish, which is the first problem. The second problem is the kids are bringing home ideas from school, and they're telling their parents that their parents are doing things the wrong way. So this has a real impact on the authority relationship in families. Instead of parents being in charge, which is sort of the assumed natural way, you actually have little kids having more authority than their parents because they're explaining to their parents how they're doing things wrong according to what their teachers and their friends are saying.
Well, I suppose especially if the children speak English and the parents don't, then the children will be able to have access to all kinds of information, important information about settling in this country that the parents wouldn't.
Well, that could be that on one hand, the kids are actually acculturating faster than their parents because the parents are, for the most part, pretty isolated in jobs where nobody is speaking English, where everybody is still speaking Spanish. They're still kind of living in these ethnic enclaves of their own kind, you know. So the parents aren't really, you know, on a daily basis the way their kids are learning what is American life as fast, right? And so the kids do become sort of the cultural authorities about what is American life. And, you know, take this out of the context of immigration. If you have kids, if you have teenagers, if you've ever experienced teenagers, teenagers think they know more than their parents, no matter what. Now, multiply that with not only the individual child standing in front of you telling you that you don't know what's going on, but you have an individual child with the weight of a whole society sitting on their shoulders, the authority of this whole United States society telling you as an immigrant parent that this is the right way to do something. And you can see how immigrant parents get rattled. They don't know. Maybe this is the way it should be here in the United States, and I don't really know the right way to do this. And you add on to that the fact that probably the parents and the kids don't even speak the same language well together anymore. The parents are still speaking Spanish. The kids now speak English really well. So we really see a lot of bicultural tensions, especially not between just teenagers and their parents, but we see the tension happening as early as second grade, right? And, you know, that's a little hard to imagine as an American parent, but, you know, imagine having that sort of power struggle that you have with teenagers.
With a seven-year-old.
What are some of the specific issues that you've seen come up where the Latino immigrant parents are being told they're doing it wrong? What would be some examples?
Well, people think of the typical things like, you know, I want to stay out till midnight and you will only let me stay out till 10, you know. But really, I think what the issues are is an interpretation of what's allowable and what's not allowable. So how do I explain this better? So, for example, immigrant parents have a lot of fears. Their kids are going to get involved in gangs. The girls are too sexually active. You know, those kind of typical concerns. So they definitely argue about those, you know. But it's not that they're arguing you're in a gang, you're having sex too soon. It's that they're arguing about the fear. So they're arguing about when, you know, what time you should come home, because that's one way that I can ensure that maybe you're getting involved in those things less, okay? There are things that are just new things. The story that we hear over and over again is my kids want to do sleepovers.
Right.
And what's a sleepover? You know, and the immigrant parents saying, well, that just sounds strange to me that you would go into a stranger's house or a stranger would come into your house. Again, it's wrapped up in fear, though. You know, it's really that I don't know what's going to happen. And, oh, I hear about all this child abuse in the United States.
And, well, and if you don't know that other family because your child is the one making the contact and you might not even have common language with that other family, then you would be wondering, should I let my son or daughter go right. off for the night with these people.
Right. So again, I guess one of the big points I want to make is see how it's an amplified fear. Like, it's not that any of us who have young children, when our kids want to go do sleepovers, we don't question it. But now add into that, you don't know the family. You don't know the culture that the family comes from. You're in the context of the U.S. where you've watched on TV all these horrible things that American families do. And all of these fears kind of add up. So it makes it much harder. I mean, it's interesting because there's sort of this idea that immigrant kids are really acculturating and their parents are very traditional. And one of the things I observed, it's not that their parents are traditional, because the parents are also adapting and changing and becoming very American too. It's just that in relationship to their kids asking to do something and them having to say no, what they do sometimes is they reach back and they grab onto their cultural values, and they'll say something to their kids like, we wouldn't do that at home in our home country. And so that makes them look very traditional. In fact, it's not that they really are. One of the reasons I'm so interested in biculturalism is I think that the typical picture is, oh, these immigrant parents who are just really traditional and haven't adapted or assimilated to U.S. society yet. And the reality is, oh, they absolutely are. There's a process of biculturalism going on every single minute of their lives. This immigrant woman who's been here for 2 years is very different than her sister, you know, who's back home in her home country, because she's already picked up so much about American life and everything. But when it comes to the parent-child relationship, you know, you're fighting for your child's safety, basically. And so you tend to pull out whatever, you know, will work. But also there is this real concern about maintaining one's culture. And again, the parents are not so traditional that they expect everything to be exactly the same. But they would like to at least see that their kids can maintain their mother tongue so that they can talk to their grandparents by phone. Or if they visit them, they actually know the correct rules about the way you interact with elders. This is a big one, is the elder issue. Like, the kids are so disrespectful. In the United States, in schools, even beginning as early as, you know, childcare settings, we teach children that they're equals with adults. You know, there's supposed to be this open conversation. You're supposed to ask questions. Mm-hmm. You know, these are the things that make for a successful American child. That's not necessarily the way that kids are being raised in Mexico. You know, they're not supposed to ask questions. They're not supposed to challenge their grandmother when she says, would you do this? You're not supposed to say, why? Right? Mm-hmm. You're just supposed to do it because that's more important. The relational aspect of being together is more important than the individual, I need an explanation before I'm going to do that and everything.
What about the different expectations for girls and boys?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there...
Gangs. We're afraid the boys are going to get into gangs. We're afraid the girls are going to be too sexually active at the teenage years seems to be the big concern. At the younger years, interestingly, I think the concern is that the boys are doing girl things. So boys playing with dolls, boys sort of, you know, this whole idea that boys and girls can play with trucks and dolls, that's a very American idea. When I've observed, that is a concern. You know, one of the adapting to the U.S. concerns is that, oh, I don't know, they're raising my son to be soft, you know, and real concern that that he's going to turn out wrong if they keep letting him play with the dolls or the girls don't learn to be a little more girl-like.
Mm-hmm. Is there a higher level of family violence among Latino families than there would be with the general American population?
You know what? I should know the answer to that question, but I don't know the statistics. I bet you that the people who work in agencies with domestic violence would tell you right out, domestic violence is equal across the board, you know, that there are not cultural things that make it more prevalent in one community or another. I think that that's sort of a movement line of philosophy in order to just make the point that domestic violence is bad for everybody. So let me answer your question more from my impression, okay? I think one of the big differences is that because of this focus on relationality, and sort of keeping the peace or keeping the family being really important, that what happens is women do have a place, for example, in Mexican culture, and I would like to be very specific to the ethnic group, where speaking up, challenging is considered less appropriate.
Women challenging men.
Yeah, challenging their husbands. And so you'll have, like, you know, if a couple is having trouble, I think you will probably hear more voices from, like, the grandparent generation in the community saying, but come on, you know, just put up with it or take, you know. But at the same time, I think there's a really strong objection to any kind of violence as well. And so while there isn't the public dialogue that challenges it, I think at the personal level, you see a lot of women walking away from men who are violent. You know, it's not like they put up with it, and it's not like they say, oh, this is my culture, I have to do this. They actually, you know, do say enough is enough, and we need to figure out other ways. Now, the problem is that...
leads to the breakup of the family, for one thing.
Right. But the problem is the experience of breaking up the family in the U.S. is going to be very different than the experience of breaking up the family if you're living in your home community in Mexico with your family around you. You have some place to go.
You got that support.
I mean, a general principle of domestic violence is isolation is the one reason people stay in bad relationships, in battering relationships. So it is actually not whether it's the culture, it's actually the structural context, you know, that where is an immigrant woman who is absolutely dependent on her partner to share childcare because one works at one time while one works at another time. So she needs him just to watch the kids so she can get to have her job, right? And they actually need all three or four of their jobs because they're not just working two jobs to really get by every day. So, and then that is all stress, and that does lead to violent behaviors. And all of this adds up, but where do you go? You know, you don't really have that option to step out. Now, in mainstream U.S. society, we think that, you know, battered women's shelters are great. They don't work for Latino families. And that's one of the main reasons we started this project on preventing domestic violence through strengthening couple communication, is that by the time a Latino family gets to the point, a Latino immigrant family gets to the point, you know, where there's a real abuse happening, the solutions are just really hard to put into place, even though we have things like restraining orders and battered women's shelters in the United States. So the philosophy of this program is we need to work with families before that even starts, just at basic communication. So the assumption is almost like you're an immigrant family, you're low income, you're going to experience stress. You are really at risk for domestic violence, right? What are we going to do now before that happens? So a lot of the workshops that we're doing about preventing domestic violence are about couple communication. How do you get people to talk to each other so that they can communicate better? That reduces stress and conflict. We do workshops on self-esteem so that everybody, and it's interesting, it's a very interesting picture, I think, because, you know, in the Latino immigrant community, when you talk about domestic violence, it's a problem that both men and women are having. The men are very recalcitrant, sad that they are abusers. They, you know, it's almost like they realize that this stress, it's not an excuse. It's just that they really realize how much stress they're under and how they don't know the right ways to communicate to avoid using physical means of solving their problems. And, you know, it's not just physical, too. It can be anger and psychological abuse as well.
Is there more, is there a greater tendency toward corporal punishment with children in the Latino culture in terms of acceptability?
Definitely acceptability. I mean, I think that's probably one of those bicultural stresses of parenting is that having come from a background where that was how they were raised, dad pulled out the belt and used it. And then they come to the United States and there are rules here. There are laws here that actually say you're not allowed to do that. And so families get into trouble with the law because they follow the practices they learned when they were growing up. And so in our bicultural parenting workshops, we do try to talk about alternatives. The difference of what we do, though, is we're not telling them it's wrong and they shouldn't do it. It's more that we say, there are laws and you really can't do it here. And here are ways that if you're going to use this kind of punishment, you know, there are ways that you're allowed to do it. You know, you're allowed to spank children on the soft part of their behinds. You're not allowed to smack them across their faces. You know, you're not. And so it's a little different, I think, than mainstream U.S. parenting classes where they try to just say it's wrong. And you absolutely should use your words and timeouts to get your kids to obey, and well, they wouldn't even use the word obey, right? To cooperate, right? So, you know, there are some cultural messages that basically say, yeah, kids are supposed to obey their parents. And then you have to come up with methods that are culturally specific to that way of thinking. So if you just tell immigrant parents, cut it off, you're not allowed to hit at all, probably they're going to keep hitting their kids. But if you provide them with reasons, like you're going to get thrown in jail, you're going to get deported, you know, and they actually know lots of people who have gotten in trouble and deported for exactly that reason.
For disciplining their children.
For disciplining their kids. And they are, it's another one of those fears. They are so afraid of getting in trouble with CPS, Child Protective Services, as much as they're afraid of getting in trouble with ICE, the Immigration Enforcement Agency.
We're going to look at some of the workshops that are being done to help Latino families when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Lynette Utall, who is filling us in about biculturalism in the Latino family and how Latino families adjust or try to adjust to life in the United States and still come out of the traditions from which they are based. So you have these workshops that are targeting preventing violence in the family. Could be anything from spouse abuse down to what might be considered fairly traditional disciplining of a child. Why would it be different, or how would these workshops be different for Latinos than they would be for anybody else?
Probably it has to do with sort of the philosophy of the workshop and how you get information to people. Most parent education workshops and domestic violence intervention programs tend to start with the idea that there is the right way to do things. And if you just teach people the right way to do things, they will change their behavior. And then whatever it is that's problematic will go down, will disappear. And as I mentioned before, the typical things in the domestic violence methods that don't work very well with Latino families, like restraining orders and leaving the family and going to a battered women's shelter. Similarly, with parent education, there's a lot of telling people what they should do and how they should change their behaviors. But the problem with the mainstream parent education workshop is it doesn't actually take into account the culture of the Latino family. And it doesn't take into account this idea that they're actually living in two worlds at one time, that they're living in two sets of social values. And those, so it's not just that there are two different sets of social values. There's actually one, the mainstream U.S. society, that is dominant, you know, and has more authority. And so, for example, like I explained before, the kids bring that authority home with them into their relationships with their parents. So the parent-child relationship is not just isolated, it's in society. And then it's also informed by the home culture where the parents were raised themselves. And so it's a difficult process to figure out what should I do when there's so many different messages that I'm getting. So what we do at our workshops is we acknowledge that. We don't try to be meaning the planning team, which includes myself, graduate students, undergraduates, as well as community partners, where we get together and we choose a topic for each workshop based on what we're hearing as a concern in the community. And then we have these workshops where we don't go in. Like we could, the typical thing, I think, is to go get an expert and have the expert give a lecture like on correct disciplining practices. And then the idea is, you know, in a traditional workshop, you can do a pre and post test to see if they learned the information. And then maybe 6 months later, check to see if they actually use those things, right? But that traditional approach of parent education really doesn't work for this community. Instead, what we do is we put the topic out on the table. When you put the topic out on the table, somebody in who the participants, as I call the community people who come to these workshops, which include both brand new immigrants as well as people who have been living in the United States for 15 or 20 years, parents as well as grandparents, okay, because we kind of see this as a community issue. So somebody is going to say, I'm having trouble with this. And then what we do in the workshop is we turn everybody into teachers. We ask everybody to give advice to that particular problem. And the hope is that that person will hear six different ways to address something, and then everybody else in the room will hear those ways, and everybody will go home with an idea of what they then can work with because it fits best with their situation. So let me give you an example, going back to that sleepover idea. Okay, so the new immigrant parent, kid gets invited to a sleepover. They're really uncomfortable with it. The parents are. Oh, the kids want to go. I mean, this is cool. You know, they're really, you know, they're being embraced by their new friends, right? Or not so new friends. So anyways, what will happen is, or what could happen, for example, in the example of the sleepover, is one parent will say, well, just say no. We don't do that in our culture, and just say no. And another parent will say, or another person will say, you have to say yes. This is America, and you have to let your kid become American. We're here now. We got to do it their way. But then you'll hear what I call sort of wiser advice. You'll get somebody who will say, okay, you know, you need to know the family. This is like exactly what you suggested earlier. So why don't you go over and meet the family? Or somebody else will say, why don't you have the kid do a sleepover at your house first? And actually, they will come up with very diverse ideas. The most interesting example of this that I heard for the sleepover was one family actually went, and this baffles me a little bit, but they went on a camping trip with the other family so that the two families got to know each other.
One big sleepover. Mm-hmm.
Right. The kid felt like they had a sleepover. And the next time, it was very easy. It was much easier once they knew each other. They had a relationship with each other. They weren't just strangers. You know, again, in U.S. society, for kids to have relationships without their parents really being involved is very typical, especially when they're teenagers, right?
Oh, yes.
But this is another way of thinking of it. Like, you know, you have friends, and it is okay for me as a parent to know who your friends are. And in fact, it's a condition. If you want to do a sleepover, I need to have this information because I, as a newcomer to this society with all my fears in my head, can't be a good parent if I just let you go when I don't know for sure that you're going
to
be safe.
I would like to think that most native-born American parents would take the same approach, that they would say, we have to know who these people are before we're going to let you spend the night over there.
Well, speaking for the immigrant parents, this is one of the things they say. They say, we don't get American parents. They just don't seem to care. You know, why are they so easy with this? Well, part of it might be like, for example, here, right here in Madison, you know, when your 7-year-old gets invited out, it might be with a family that you've known since, you know, you had them in childcare together and you saw each other when you were dropping your kids off. So it may be that American parents look like they care less because they actually already have these established relationships. I tend to agree with the immigrant parents that American parents are much more relaxed and trusting about letting strangers have their kids, you know. But see, right there, I've identified probably one of the biggest concerns that your children are so important. Why would you be casual about who you let them be with?
You know? What about a more serious issue that would come up, such as you know, smacking a child on the face.
Mm-hmm.
How would that be handled in the sort of workshop, multiple advice approach?
Well, one of the characteristics of biculturalism is that everybody is at a different stage of the process. So again, you know, somebody comes in and this will happen. They'll say, you know, my child did this. And as an aside, they sort of say, and so I smacked her across the face. Okay. And you will get, again, this array of responses. One response is no response. That's normal. Another response will be somebody who's like saying, no, 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 you shouldn't treat your children like that, you know, and because they've been to those mainstream parenting workshops, they can say, you know, you should do something different, you know, like instead, why don't you give her a timeout? Another parent will say, has nothing to do with the actual physical discipline, no, they're going to take you to jail if you keep doing that, you know. So, again, the idea in these workshops is to let all of these different views and ideas come to the surface without the people who are running the facilitators telling them that any of those ways are right or wrong. And then there's a discussion, you know, to discuss, and it's a debate. People will start, you know, really disagreeing about whether it's okay to hit or not. And you can kind of feel in the room that this side of the room is very upset that there's any kind of physical discipline happening at all. And this other side of the room is like not even thinking it's an issue, and this group is worrying about, you know, Child Protective Services is going to come in. We as the facilitators don't label any of that as right or wrong. We let it happen, and then it's up to each person to decide for their own personal circumstances which works best for them and their personal family.
You as a facilitator, then you find this work satisfying and rewarding, and you're seeing progress?
Well, one of the things that's really important is that because everybody's a co-learner in this process, you don't have – what I find really satisfying about it is actually watching the people who are supposed to be the experts learn about the communities that they're supposed to be serving and learning that they don't always have the right answers. The partners who I work with – so taking another step back a little bit – I don't speak Spanish fluently that I would ever be in front of the room facilitating. So the facilitators are always one of my community partners who speak Spanish fluently. And many of them, especially in the Preventing Domestic Violence Project, are people who have learned, like, these are the typical steps that you take when somebody's experiencing domestic violence, or they have ideas about how you develop self-esteem to prevent somebody putting up with domestic violence. But what I hear from them is that while they are experts, their jobs, they're so overwhelmed by so many clients, so few resources, so few bilingual experts, that they actually see people so fast that they don't get a chance to really hear how people are processing information or how they're living their lives. So this particular method, which we call the facilitated dialogical method, is really wonderful because I think that the professionals are also learning about the lives of the people that they're working with in a much deeper way than they would if they did a traditional workshop or just carried on in their jobs in their traditional way.
Well, thank you for sharing your work with us. It's fascinating.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Lynette Utall. I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.